This is chapter 13 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smylie. This chapter is entitled Blot Out His Name Then. Commissioner Rothes and Sir Thomas Dalel, with James Sharp, to instigate and encourage had established their reign of violence and avarice. They followed Rullian Green with wickednesses which proved how strong their wish was to exterminate the wandering and weather-beaten flock of Christ. Not only were fines doubled and trebled, not only were there in Edinburgh and Glasgow and Ayr the public executions of the ringleaders, but up and down the country, when the survivors of the ill-starred rising were caught by the troopers, they were shot at their own doors. There was many a pathetic incident in connection with the evils, extortions, cruelties and exactions of the time. Thus we read in Naphtali of a country boy of 16, who was bidden renounce the covenant which he had taken at Lanark. He had no skill in spiritual matters, no wisdom such as the more advanced scholars of Christ have reached, and no full assurance of his personal salvation. He fell into great anxiety, for he was not prepared to die, and yet he could not redeem his life with the price which the persecutors proposed. Before the end, all the windows of his heart were opened to the day. After the prayers and conference of some who saw him in prison at Irvine, he went to his doom, leaping and praising God through all the west and over most of the lowlands during the winter of 1666 and 1667. The Covenanters could never tell from what lurking place swift death might spring out on them. But the tormentors went too far. The man who broke the power of Middleton 3 years before, and to whom Rothes protested an unchangeable affection, was watching them. Lauderdale saw that if he would keep his credit, the blundering policy of a merciless severity must be modified in Scotland. He detected, too, a movement against his own supremacy, a movement in which the Commissioner, despite his fervent assurances, and the Archbishop, who avowed his loyalty in obsequious terms, and Dalel and the Duke of Hamilton, all had their share. The prelates, for Alexander Burnet of Glasgow, had his finger in the matter, as well as his Grace of St. Andrews, and the military party both alike wanted to humble the lordly statesman, who meant to be the Grand Vizier of an autocratic king. Evidently, it was time for Lauderdale to bestir himself. He did it with much effect. First, he brought James Sharp in cringing humility to his feet. Aided by Sir Robert Moray and the Earl of Tweedale, men of honour in whom he could absolutely trust, and men of compassion who hated the unmitigated brutalities which had been in vogue, he frightened the domineering churchmen into abject submission. Remember that James Sharp was the Archbishop of St. Andrews. So completely did Sharp desert his ally, Dalel, that one day the Muscovian beast turned on him with a growl. "Whensoever the bishops are stoned, you deserve to be the first." There were no limits either to the primate's recantations or to his misgivings. He was sure that the end of his pomps and plots had come. At length, when the humiliation had been carried sufficiently far and the knave had gotten the second sight through experience and not for naught, Lauderdale ordered him to rise from his knees. Even yet he was scared. Sir Robert Moray pleads laughingly that his master will induce the king to write two lines to him with his own hand, for nothing less will raise his heart, which is bemisted and lodged in his hose. So Charles, at Lauderdale's prompting, writes the two lines, and then the winter of the Archbishop's discontent becomes glorious summer. His Majesty's hand, he says with the diamond seal, was to me as a resurrection from the dead. The whole transaction hashes a searchlight into the dispositions of the men who were principals in it. Lauderdale, with quiet masterfulness, with perfect temper, with steady unscrupulousness, and Sharp, who can be bullied and cajoled with ease, and who is certain to be found on that side which promises success to himself. Among the church's oppressors, none is more to be dreaded than the first, and none more to be despised than the second. Rothes, with his coarse and glaring sins, had not the primate's craven spirit. Yet Lauderdale had decided that he too must be rendered harmless. He persuaded the king to transfer the earl from the position of royal commissioner to that of Lord Chancellor, vacant since the death of Glencairn 3 years previously. In his new office, he would have a dignity quite as stately as in the old, but his opportunities of working mischief would be at an end. Rothes himself was frankly averse to the change. When Sir Robert Moray went to tell him about it, he had to talk for hours. It was 8 o'clock ere we parted, and even then the negotiation had made meagre progress. He had no ability, the Earl declared, for such work as the Chancellor's. He was not a lawyer. He knew little Latin. He was ignorant of statutes and precedents. How could he state a question as it should be stated? He opposed his youth, his humour, his way, and always, like the needle quivering back to the pole, he returned to his unwillingness, which he expressed to be high and insuperable. Moray had need that day of the cleverness and the patience with which he was dowered. To every point, he said, I found replies that still innovate them to my thinking. What purpose, he asked in the end, could there be in prolonging the resistance? The king's resolution was fixed, and it were much handsomer that Rothes should yield at the first than at the last. Of course, there was but one termination to the debate, though it was resumed again and again. Rothes had to surrender. On the 24th of September 1667, he wrote himself to Lauderdale, laying down his commissionership and requesting the all-powerful secretary to express to the king his passionate desire to kiss his hands. And who was to be the new commissioner? Who but Lauderdale in his own person? He would take the reins himself and would vanquish the mettlesome and recalcitrant steed. Or let us adopt Lord Tweedale's metaphor. The news pleased me well, he said, that the keys shall hang at the right belt. For nearly a decade and a half, Lauderdale governed Scotland with a proconsul's absolutism. From Galloway to the Grampians, his wish was law. We must look a little more carefully at the man who wielded a sceptre so potent. John Maitland, the Earl of Lauderdale, was a lost leader. He deserted the allies of his earlier years. In the old days, none had seemed more zealous than he. When the Kirk had its highest honours to confer, he was one of its chosen. Back in the December of 1643, when he was in his gracious youth, Robert Bailey wrote with emphasis of the very great sufficiency and happiness of good Maitland as a commissioner to the Westminster Assembly. It is true that he never had been a protester like his fellow delegates, Rutherford and Warriston. He brought away the engagement from the Isle of Wight, but only mournful necessity, he explained, led him to meddle with such compromises. He told his covenanting associates how sore against his heart he went the road now he was in. By and by, when the moderate men were broken at Preston, he expressed before the courts of the church his penitence for having lowered that flag which he should have been proud to carry aloft. The leaders of Presbytery took him unquestioningly into their confidence again, and he remained their loving friend. He was so when, after Worcester, the English government threw him into confinement, first in the Tower and then in other southern jails. And during the years of his incarceration, there was never a suspicion of his leal-heartedness. From prison he sent to Scotland letters which spoke the dialect of Zion, letters full of tranquil courage and acquiescence in the will of God. His correspondents rejoiced in a helper so convinced and ardent. Was it a long-drawn-out imposture? Dr. Osmond Airy, who is at home in the second Charles's reign, as a man is at home in the house where he has lived for years, says yes. Lauderdale, he believes, assumed this seal like a player putting on his stage accoutrements. He hoodwinked the Kirk he disliked until the opportunity came for escaping from the meshes of its net. He was a conscious hypocrite. One wonders whether that is the only solution of this problem in personality with its abysmal deeps. Perhaps there is another answer. John Maitland may have deceived himself as well as his brethren in the camp of the Covenant. Shrewd and sagacious men have sometimes misread their own souls, and he may have been of their fellowship. He may have dreamed that his Presbyterian comrades were right when they assured him, in the plenitude of their faith and hope and love, that he would go to the saints. But however we interpret the early section of his biography, the Restoration awakened Lauderdale and led him out from the world of illusions to the world which was his own. The true man had full play now. There was nobody who enjoyed such intimacy with Charles, and nobody who kept the friendship unshaken through so long a period. Clarendon, to whom the king's debt was deepest, was disgraced. but Lauderdale, of whom Clarendon felt an invincible distrust, remained to glory over his rival's abasement. An uncouth-looking favourite he was. He made a very ill appearance, Bishop Burnet says. He was very big, his hair red, hanging oddly about him. His tongue was too big for his mouth, which made him bedew all that he talked to, and his whole manner was rough and boisterous. His portrait, although Lely's consummate art has done for it everything which could be done, attests the accuracy of the gossiping bishop's delineation. The forehead is low, the cheeks are loose, the lips are thick and insatiable, the body is huge and brutish. The sovereign, well aware of his own ugliness, felt some satisfaction, it may be surmised, in the reflection that his confidant and boon companion was uglier than himself. But concealed behind the unlovely features, there was an alert brain. We are told that in all companies, Lauderdale had much to say. He was full of ideas and expedients. Buckingham's epigram, "He is a man of a blundering understanding," may have had its side of truth, but his was an intellect capacious and fertile and resourceful. He matured his plans with calm coolness, and he never lacked the courage required to carry them into effect. He was utterly cynical in his judgments of men and things, as hopelessly cynical as his royal patron. Year in and year out his selfishness kept watch, and no fair words or plausible professions lulled it into slumber. In his treatment of Middleton, and in his victory over Sharp and Rothes, we have seen how he could choose the psychological moment for winning a personal triumph. He showed keen penetration also in the agents whom he gathered about him. He knew and intimate said, how to make use of a knave, but yet there was a magnetism which men higher in the moral scale than himself were forced to own. He was helped by public servants who were very perfect gentle knights. Bad or good, they found him a despotic master. He employed them just so long as they furthered his interests, but if they should contradict, he bade them goodbye, with a regret and with no thanks. His king and himself, these were Lauderdale's deities, the great twin brethren, and they occupied thrones of equal dignity. He would take a cartload of oaths, he declared, as irreconcilable as it is possible to conceive, rather than forget his majesty or forfeit his own power. The man is a medley, a bundle of opposing qualities. There were few scholars in Britain more versatile. There was none in the precincts of the court. To his dear Robin, that Robert Moray, who, if he had allowed it, would have been his good angel, he writes from Holyrood in July 1663, and this is a sentence in the letter: "Send with him, with Lord Dunfermline, my little octavo Hebrew Bible without points, which lies in my little closet at Whitehall. Other things are to be dispatched too, which have a different aroma. Glasses of spirit of roses, which you will find in the middle of drawer of my walnut tree cabinet. But here is a student who shares John Milton's partiality for the Old Testament in the original tongue. He was as conversant with the Greek and Latin classics and with ancient and modern history. He had a Scotsman's delight in theological discussion and speculation. His weary imprisonment assisted him to accumulate these stores of erudition. But not one captive in 100 would have compelled the years of durance to yield so rich a harvest. And yet side by side with the culture was spiritual degeneracy there was. What spiritual degeneracy there was. Lauderdale was as rank a sensualist as could be found in Charles's palace of misrule. His vices were notorious. It was difficult for him to speak without an oath or a lie. A frequent exercise of his humour was to make puns on the verses of Scripture, or to mimic the accents and gestures of the covenanting preachers to whom he had listened in his more honourable youth. There was, moreover, an element of superstition, which all intellectual attainment could not banish. He never liked James Sharp. He said to Lord Melville once, Woodrow relates that he knew that the Archbishop would come to a violent end. Asked why, he answered that he had detected infallible tokens of catastrophe in the little tricks of gait and demeanour which he observed about the obnoxious priest. Happing when he walked like a pite, and winking with one eye, and keeping the thumb in his fingers when he spoke. My lord, added the king's secretary of state, I never saw one that had these signs who died an ordinary death. Is he not a marvellous conglomerate, scholarly, capable above 9/10 of his contemporaries, familiar with the truth and yet the slave of passion and profaneness and credulity. There is a word of the divine teacher which is peculiarly applicable to John, Earl of Lauderdale. It is that word which smites like a sword and saddens like the Arctic winter. If the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? The friends of the older time were aghast at the change. A few months before his own death, Robert Bailey, once so assured of Lauderdale's devotion, sent him a letter of brave and touching reproof. My lord, you are the nobleman in the world I love best and esteem most. I think I may say and write to you what I like. If you have gone with your heart to forsake your covenant, to countenance the reintroduction of bishops and books, and strengthening the king by your advice in these things, I think you a prime transgressor and liable among the first to answer to God for that great sin, and opening a door which in haste will no be closed for persecution of a multitude of the best persons and most loyal subjects that are in the three dominions. It may be doubted indeed whether the condemned member of the Westminster Assembly approved of the bringing back of the of episcopacy. That's quondam member, I'm not sure what that means. People said that to the close of his life he was a Presbyterian at heart, and probably Bernard is right when he tells us that privately the secretary urged Charles against the treachery, but in public he interposed no obstacle. If he would never have advised, he forbore to curb. And that, in a man with his antecedents and his influence, was a crime. And besides Bailey, there was another friend whom his evil behaviour cut to the quick. Richard Baxter had hoped great things of him. His were among the books which the captive studied in his various dungeons, reading them all and taking notes of them, and earnestly commending them to his kinsman, the Earl of Balcarres. In fact, when his hour of glory came, Lauderdale, as we learn from Reliquiae Baxteriane, had desired to carry the author of the Saints' Best north of Scotland and to give him a bishopric there, and the great Puritan had difficulty in evading his importunities. But now the preacher was filled with pity and indignation and fear. A noble letter survives, written about 1670, in which he begs the recreant to turn and live. God forbid that you should lose in prosperity that which you gained in adversity, and that he who was near you in a prison should be put far from you in a court. If our hearts once say to him, depart from us, it's a sad prognostic that we may hear from him at last. Depart from me. Depart from me, my lord, I am not persuading you for the securing of your soul to leave the court, that you may escape temptations. I know if all good men should do so on that pretence, they would but desert their trust and the commonwealth and the interest of Christ. There's cowardly soldiers that will quit the field for fear of being wounded, or slothful workmen that will quit the vineyard for fear of doing their work amiss. This were to give up all as deplorable, but I beseech you, watch and walk with God. It were a miserable life that should imprison your soul in smoky vanity and shut you out from your communion with God. This were to be debased below those poorest Christians that in a cottage and in rags have daily access to him in prayer and holy meditation. It were a miserable honour that should depress you, and a miserable gain that should bring upon you so great a loss. These are among the yearning sentences in an appeal, a consio ad cor, remarkable for its fidelity and its love. Lauderdale could not allege that he had received no warning of his declension and danger. The best men whom he knew followed him, and as he went deeper and deeper down, with regretful eyes and with prayers that he would bethink himself before it was too late. But he never did. He was determined to be indispensable to Charles. He was as drunken and vicious as Rochester. His wit, if it was heavier, was more mordant. He could talk in Latin, in Italian, in French, even in Hebrew. All these were endowments which commended him to the king. In London, from 1660 to 1667, he courted his master with such assiduity that no presence was so essential as his, and by 1667 he was the real ruler of Scotland. Thus John Maitland, once the hope of the Presbyterians, mounted higher and higher in magnificence and sank lower and lower in manhood and grace. tragic end to a man who began well.